From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Unapologetic good troublemaker Julie Farnham returns to the show this week. Julie Farnham served as the assistant and then acting director of intelligence for the United States Capitol Police during one of the most tumultuous periods in this country's history. During her time there, she oversaw the identification and vetting of nearly 20,000 threats against members of Congress, most of which were made by U.S. citizens who adhered to extreme ideologies. She also warned of potential violence on January 6, 2021. Prior to joining the Capitol Police, Farnham served with the Department of Homeland Security for over 15 years. She holds a master's degree in intercultural relations from Lesley University, and she's the author of the book, Domestic Darkness, An Insider's Account of the January 6th Insurrection and the Future of Right-Wing Extremism. Julie Farnham, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
You were here a little while ago, and we talked extensively about your book, so I have some other things that I want to follow up with you about today. So you ran for public office this year, and you were not successful in your bid, and some people posted some really mean and some very stupid things about you online, and I wonder if the experience was discouraging, and are you now going to look for a job as a greeter at the Walmart?
Not headed to Walmart just yet, but I'm also not planning to run for office anytime soon again. It was a good experience. I think, you know, the criticism and things like that, that goes with the territory when you're running for office, regardless of what you're running for, or who's running, and regardless of, you know, the political party. I think both sides do it. You know, I was running in Arlington, Virginia. I'm a centrist. I'm pretty logical. I think of, like, you know, approach things with, you know, common sense and being reasonable. And Arlington's a very, very left-leaning county. And it's hard to be a centrist in that. And I think it's in a lot of places, too. We have people going further right and further left and not a lot of people in the middle anymore. And that's, you know, I think probably why we have so much division and we have the situation we have now in politics. And I think we do need more people to come together on both sides, you know, Republicans and Democrats. But, you know, it was a good experience. I did not love campaigning, to be honest. I surprised myself. I thought I would like it better than I did, but I really didn't love that. But I'm glad I did it. And, you know, on to other things now.
Well, you know, I am, like, you know, really thin skinned, and, you know, I can't tolerate, you know, the slightest criticism of anything. Like, 3 weeks ago, a woman said to me, oh, you look like you've gained weight. And so I haven't eaten solid food. And in that case, you know, it was entirely true. So, I mean, do you ever get used to, I mean, not just in, when you run for politics, but in your career, do you ever get used to people saying completely cruel and untrue things about you?
I don't know if you get used to it. I mean, it's still, like, it's hurtful. Like, you're a person. And I think what bothers me, you know, I can take the criticism. I think what bothers me is the untruth. And there's a lot of that. And I see a lot of that online, you know, about me, about other people as well. And that's what's really frustrating, because, you know, you want to defend yourself. And at some point, you just need to, like, recognize people are just, it's just noise. And, like, don't, because sometimes I think when you respond, and, like, it takes a lot to not respond. And I do respond from time to time. But, you know, you're giving them, like, credibility by, like, acknowledging their rhetoric. And in some regards, it's just better to just, like, let it go, just, like, block them and move on.
Have your daughters, I mean, I don't know to what level your daughters read what thing people say, but if they say, Mom, is it true that you're the devil incarnate?
No. I try to limit. I made a deal with them and said, you know, if you stay off social media until you graduate high school, I will take you on a trip to wherever you want to go. So far that's working, but we haven't fully approached, like, the teenage years yet. So we'll see if that lasts. But I do try to keep them off social media, because they don't, it's not just stuff they could read about me. It's just stuff in general and like how the algorithms are manipulated to like show them certain things and the damage it can have for especially young girls. I just don't want them online.
I totally understand it. It's the thing about technology is that it gives us so many great things, like you and I are talking and looking at each other right now from across the country, and yet it also brings us such horrible things, you know, like in equal measure. Well, running for office, I guess, was the natural extension of what you've been doing, you know, in the last few years. You worked for Homeland Security, you worked for the DC police. And I wonder what makes a person go into public service?
That's a good question. You know, when I started my career in the government, before I started, so I went to grad school, got my master's in intercultural relations. And during my time there, I was volunteering in the immigration clinic at the International Rescue Committee. So doing the immigration work for recently resettled refugees. And I was like, oh, I kind of like this immigration thing. And so that's really what motivated me to go into public service. I thought like I liked working with immigrants in the immigrant community. I liked learning different things and, you know, different people, different cultures, all of it. I mean, well, my degree is in intercultural relations. So clearly I had that interest before I started to work in the government. But I think it really gave me an opportunity to flourish. I really felt at home in the government and I liked that I had the opportunity to grow and that they would invest in like developing me. And so, you know, I started at U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services in Boston. I was what they call an Immigration Service Officer 1. It wasn't called that when I was there. But, you know, I was the person at the front counter, and you learn immigration really fast because you have people like literally in your face yelling at you, crying, everything else. Like, you better have an answer. But you also learn how to deal with people and how to communicate in those situations. And then I went over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Homeland Security Investigations for a couple of years after that. And that was the criminal end of things. I was not doing administrative immigration work. I was doing human rights violator cases. We had a case in, you know, this is public information, out of Bosnia, human rights violator, cases out of people who committed the Rwandan genocide. There was a little pocket of them up in New England. And so those types of cases I was working on, and I really appreciated seeing the other side of the immigration debate, because now I'm like, you know, fully, like I understand the debate now. And I've been down to the border, both the north and the south border. And so I've really seen it, and I've really had the opportunity to see all these different facets of immigration during my career. And I loved it. I loved it. U.S. citizenship. And so I worked for ICE for 2 years, 2.5 years. Then I went to D.C., back to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and just climb the ranks there. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is self-funded, or at least they were when I was there. So they're funded by the application fee. So your application for green card and for naturalization, that's how they're funded. During the pandemic, with the restricted immigration policies and also offices were just closed, they were furloughing a lot of people. And that's the only reason why I left. And, you know, in some regards, I do regret leaving because I really loved working there. I felt like they were my work family. They were people that I had worked with, you know, for years at that point. And so, yeah, I mean, I think if I had to do it over again, I would probably not have gone to the Capitol Police. Would have stayed at USCIS, taken the furlough, figured out a way to, you know, make it work without a paycheck for a few months. But that didn't happen. And here we are.
The rest is history. Well,
yes.
I'm a little discouraged that you're discouraged after running for office. That's not something you think you'll do again, because I think you'd be good at it just because you lost.
Thank you.
There's
thank
no reason
you.
Not to do it again.
The thing is, and this has nothing to do necessarily with running for office, but I'm naturally a more introverted, shy person. People don't always recognize that, because I've worked hard at being like more outgoing and social, but mingling is really difficult for me. Like, it is not something I'm comfortable doing. It's not something I like to do. And all the introverts out there can relate. But I really, really, really hate mingling. And you do a lot of that when you're campaigning. And I just always felt like so awkward, and I didn't know what to say to people, and it was just like not a pleasurable experience. Whereas like debating, I was really good at that, and I really enjoy that. And that's probably not surprising given the stuff that I've done with the books and things. But I don't know, I was talking to some friends and they're like, why don't you, if you ever move, like run for office again, but in a different location? And I'm from Boston originally. I'm like, yeah, I mean, I think cutting my teeth either, between working on Capitol Hill and also running for office in Arlington, which is such like a politically charged location. Like I could probably run circles around people, someplace outside of the National Capital Region. Because, I've got those political chops now, but it's just hard to run here. And so I don't think I would run here again.
Well, Julie Farnham, you bring up an interesting thing, which is the difference between running and serving. I mean, if you'd gotten past the running, you would be excellent at serving, but you have to be running first.
Right, thank you. Yes. And yeah, and my consultant when I was running, he's like, a lot of people don't like campaigning, and I find that the people who really don't like campaigning are better at governing. And I believe that to be true. He's like, people who like campaigning, he's like, I don't know what's wrong with them.
Right, well, right, because it's asking people, please love me and give me your money and these thing, kinds of things, which are really difficult to do, whether you're shy or not. Let's talk about a little bit of politics as we're looking at this election year right now. Are you optimistic about Vice President Harris' campaign for the presidency?
I am. I really am. I was worried, to be honest, when Biden, was running. Of course, I'm not voting for Trump, but I didn't think Biden was going to be able to get it done. And so I was really excited that he did make the decision that he did. And I think it's really, it's a selfless act because so many politicians on both sides, they want that recognition and that power. And for him to be like, okay, I'm going to step aside because I think he knew. He's been in politics for, decades and decades and decades. He knows how politics works, and he knew it wasn't a winning race at this point. And so for him to be able to put his own ambitions aside and turn it over to Kamala, I think is great. And I think at least what I'm hearing around here, I don't know where it is where you are, but we're very energized, very organized, fully behind her. And so we've got a little less than 90 days at the time we're recording this. So she's just gonna hold it together to get to the finish line.
Well, a lot has been written about former President Trump, including by you, as a threat to democracy and that he's a fascist in favor of authoritarian rule over the United States. But isn't that just Democrats smearing him so that they can force us to become socialists and outlaw cows?
No, 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 I don't think so.
No?
It's interesting because, with Trump, he mirrors some of like the things that we saw with the uprising of the Nazi Party, like things, his assaults on the media, some of the terminology he uses, and that's been well reported. With like the whole slogan "Make America Great Again," like Hitler said something very similar about Germany as he was rising to power, calling people vermins, treating people as like others, like they're non-human, that they are, like dehumanizing people. Those are things that are very, very dangerous in any government, in any country. And to have that, and he said things like, maybe I'll be a dictator on the first day, praising neo-Nazis in Charlottesville, saying they were very fine people. Those sorts of things and that sort of rhetoric is very, very dangerous. Government aside, like it's dangerous to any society and to any culture because it's hateful and it's not valuing people. It's just not valuing people. You can have your differences. You don't have to agree with everything that people say. You don't have to agree with their political positions, but you need to respect people as fellow human beings. And Trump doesn't do that. And that's what's dangerous.
Well, you know, a lot of people have said that all politicians lie, and that's probably a reasonable statement. For instance, when President Kennedy was running for president in 1960, he ran on the issue of a missile gap between the Soviet Union and the United States. And then he was briefed by the Defense Department and told that, yes, there's a missile gap. We have 1,000 more missiles than they will ever have. And so what you're saying is, you know, not true. And he did not stop running on his missile gap thing, and he continued to talk about it as though he hadn't been told the truth. And that's what my friend Julie Farnham tells me is disinformation, which is a way of saying lying. You know, isn't Trump just another politician who lies? Like, because they all do.
He is, but I think what we see, what's different about him is when he's caught in lies, he's not, it doesn't prohibit him, or it doesn't hinder him from continuing to lie or for telling the next lie. And, you know, in a lot of ways, he's, I'm trying to think of how to say it, like he doesn't have any like moral compass is what it comes down to. You can catch, you know, politicians in lies and they might deny it. I think Menendez is a good example, right? Like he was just convicted. He's denying it. I mean, that's lying on a whole different level. I mean, that's, you know, like espionage and all sorts of crazy things. And he's been convicted and he denies it, but there were like political repercussions for him, or I think there will be. He did say he was stepping down, I believe.
Yeah,
and so like there were political repercussions for him. For Trump and the people who follow Trump, there really isn't any consequences to his lying, and he keeps lying and people keep believing him. And I think there's a difference too there in that when a politician's caught in a lie, they can spin it a certain way or they can, you know, backtrack. But Trump doesn't do that. And he instead is like, well, you should believe the lie.
Right,
and people do believe the lie. And that's where I think the distinction is between just a regular politician lying or saying what they need to say to get elected versus someone who perpetually lies and makes you believe the lie.
The Vice President Harris's husband was pointing out that when President Trump talked about Vice President Harris suddenly being black, where she was never black before, now she's black. That was a tactic because everybody stopped talking about issues and stopped talking about the 2025 project. And we're just talking about this ridiculous thing that he said. Do you think that's accurate?
I think it is to a degree in that it gives him a lot of attention too. And that comes down to the media too, because we've seen this over and over and over with him. He says something outrageous, and it gets the attention, but we keep talking about it. So in that regard, yeah, I mean, he does take he diverts the attention from a policy issue to, you know, a personal issue and personally attacking someone. Although I think with this last time, you know, race relations in the United States is testy. We still have a long ways to go. There still is a lot of racism. And so to make it an issue about race, I don't think that won him any voters, and he probably lost some voters in that. And I don't think he anticipated that. I think he overestimated the loyalty of, you know, some of the people who were supporting him.
Well, I was watching Face the Nation the other day, and Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton was on, and he said that Vice President Harris not only wanted to ban cows, but wanted to eliminate oil and gas production in this country, and she wants to ban gas-powered cars, and she wants to confiscate private firearms. Nobody said on the show, oh, those things are not true. So, I mean, he said them, so they must be true. Nobody stopped him.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He'll take like a little, like, say it is, okay, we should ban assault weapons. And then it gets expanded to she's taking away all your guns. And that's, you know, a tactic that we see employed at all levels of government, especially where that's, you know, an issue on the ballot. And so you're taking like a small grain of truth and then expanding it out to make it be like this is your whole policy when that's not the truth. And, you know, and it does come down to like the people who are asking the questions of these candidates, then like test them on it because they do. I mean, Kellyanne Conway, I think, is the perfect example. She has it down to an art form. You might not agree with what she has to say, but as far as communication goes, like she is a master because she'll take a word that's in the question, repeat it back so it makes it sound like you're answering the question, and then pivot to whatever she wants to talk about. And it's up to the person who's doing the interview to really key in on that and be like, but no, I asked you X, Y, and Z, and like bring it back. I think you see George Stephanopoulos do it sometimes on the Sunday morning programs and like really push people. But, you know, politicians, skilled politicians on both sides are quite good at not talking fully about what the question is. It's something that, you know, I did when I was running for office. I was trying to be pretty forthright, but, you know, that's one of the things the consultant told me. He's like, you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. So just make it sound like you're answering the question. And it's true. Like that's what they do. That's what politicians do.
But then you didn't get elected because you didn't evade questions properly.
That is probably some of it. I answered them truthfully and honestly, and people don't like that necessarily.
Yes, you must learn to be more evasive. Julie Farnham, you worked at Homeland Security for years, and you told me the last time we spoke here on From the Bookshelf that you helped craft the immigration policy of Pete Buttigieg when he was a presidential candidate in 2020. And many Americans feel that President Trump is much stronger on immigration than Vice President Harris. And Tom Cotton, for instance, said that she wants to do things like take away your health insurance on the job and give it to illegal aliens, and that she wants to decriminalize illegal immigration into this country.
Yeah, Trump, actually, I'm working on an op-ed about this very topic. Trump does not have a strong history or record on immigration. So I was the USCIS representative on the transition team. So every agency within DHS had a representative that went to DHS headquarters and was embedded with Trump's transition team. And so I was the USCIS representative. And I was sitting in on those meetings about building the walls. And, you know, he did not build very much of the wall. President Bush built more wall. President Obama built some wall, but President Trump really did not build much wall. And most of the wall that he built was actually reinforcing existing wall and repairing existing wall. So for him to say I was really strong in immigration, it wasn't. And even if you look back at like Obama's records on deportation and Bush's records on deportation, stronger than Trump's. And there needs to be a balance. Like to have a functional immigration system, it can't be all good and all bad. You know, there are people who don't deserve to be here. And I'm not necessarily talking about people who are just here working and trying to do better for their lives, but there are people who have committed fraud, who've committed crimes. And I'll just note too that the instances of criminals amongst immigrants is actually less than what it is against natural born Americans too. And that's another statistic that I think is abused, you know, by politicians. So if you look at some of those things, he really does not have a very good record on immigration. And, you know, with Vice President Harris, she was really charged not to be the border czar. She was charged to figure out what was going on in Central America to see why were people coming to the United States. And that's an effort that has been ongoing for a while. Trump didn't do much of that. I think, you know, if you want to address the issues of the southern border, you need to figure out why are people coming to the southern border. And if you can address those like downstream issues, then you're going to have more success and it's not going to be as taxing as on the border patrol agents. And I think, you know, that's what Vice President Harris was charged to do. And I think she did make strides there. Trump's foreign policy, his record on that is awful too. He didn't want to cooperate with other countries. So he didn't really have much success when it comes to immigration. I'll note too, when I was on the transition team, he had all these like executive orders that came out right when he took office. They had really tight timelines for implementation, like impossible to do in the government. So what we did was we took a lot of things that had already been started under the Obama administration and repackaged them for responding to his executive orders. So a lot of Trump's like immigration hardline stuff was actually stuff that was already starting or in the works under Obama that was just repurposed for his mandates.
Is a wall a useful tool in preventing immigration?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. Like, yes, like physically it is hard to like climb over a really tall wall. But the other part of it is like, if you can get people to just not want to cross in the first place, you wouldn't necessarily need a wall. And so it needs to be a combination of both efforts. And I've been down, I've been to Yuma, I've been to El Paso. So I've seen the border, I've seen the border crossings. And, you know, it's a really complex issue. And like, there are a lot, and one of the reasons why Trump is not successful with his wall is that a lot of that land along the southern border is privately owned. And so if your position is like the government interferes too much and government shouldn't be taking away, you know, your civil liberties and things, to have the government come in and take away private land, that's, you know, incongruent with your other positions. And so that's why a lot of the wall isn't going to get built. So, I mean, there's going to be a balance there. There are probably places along the southern border where a wall makes sense, but for long-term efforts to not have people come to the border, it has to be more of figuring out like why they're coming to the border.
Well, Julie Farnham, when we spoke last time about your book, Domestic Darkness, you said to me that the president really doesn't play that big a role in the immigration policy or the world of immigration. Why do you feel this way?
Because it's really up to Congress to address the immigration issues that we have. And I think that immigration bill that was, you know, proposed start of the year was actually a pretty good bill. What I think we need to see more of is changes in the asylum processing in this country. Not to get too into the weeds, but when someone comes to the border, asks for asylum, they have something called a credible fear or reasonable fear hearing. So like, you're not really looking at the merits of the case at that point. You just want to know, like, do they have enough to make a asylum claim? Most of those hearings are approved and then they're allowed to apply for asylum. And so there were some changes in that law with the asylum process that I think would have really benefited border security, because, you know, there are most of the people who are coming in over the border are not bad people, but there are some bad people. And when you have such an influx, then it makes it harder. It's just more taxing on the border patrol and sorting out. And so if you only have, you know, 5 people instead of 25 people to look at, it's a lot easier to, you know, process those individuals and give them the amount of time that they need. So we make sure that we're not letting dangerous people in. And so that's where I think, you know, Congress needs to do their job. Congress needs to pass immigration reform. You can blame Trump, you can blame Harris, you can blame Biden, you name the president. But if Congress isn't going to change the law, there's so many limitations on what a president can do.
Are there millions of immigrants coming across the border every day?
Not millions, no. Not millions.
But they said there was. Are they lying?
Isn't that, I think the last like number of undocumented immigrants that I heard is somewhere around 11 million. And that's probably, you know, a very liberal number too. It's probably maybe not even that much, but you know, yeah. Are there millions of undocumented immigrants here in the United States? Yes. Are they coming, millions coming every single day? No. But I mean, you look around like, who's, you know, working, you know, at the gas station, who's they're immigrants. They're part of our community. They're a fabric of our community. And they're like, they want a better life for their kids. They want to make money. They're doing jobs that are very important in our community. And so like, okay, like they just want to work. They want to do their job and they want the opportunity to succeed.
President Trump says they're doing black jobs.
Whatever that means.
Simone Biles said, held up her gold medal the other day and said, I love my black job. What about, so you were mentioning the northern border. How come there's not people flooding across? Why don't we build a wall up there? How come countries in Europe don't have walls between them?
Well, because you get an EU passport, you can go wherever you want to go. Yeah, we can get a North American passport, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, so like the northern border, I mean, it's sparsely populated for the most part. And it's cold. Like, I don't want to be climbing through the trees in the forest up there, although it's hot on the southern border. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, in it's different. I mean, Canada and Mexico are different places, right? They're definitely different places. And Mexico has a lot of corruption. There's a lot of cartels, particularly along the border. But that gets into a whole nother issue. Like the cartels, part of it is like there's a demand. There, it's a business, supply and demand. There is a demand for their goods here in the United States, and it's very, very profitable. So, I mean, it's they're just two different places, two different governments, different issues, different problems.
Well, I want to circle back around to Trump for a minute. If you're a Democrat, then, you know, you suffered through the Reagan administration and then the Bush administration and then the next Bush administration. And if you're a Republican, then you had to suffer through, you know, President Clinton and President Obama. So why would it be any different to have to suffer through another 4 years of Donald Trump? I mean, is it really that big a deal?
Yeah, I do think it is a big deal. I mean, for, you know, Reagan and the Bushes and then Obama and the Clinton, Bill Clinton, you can object to the way they're implementing policies, the policies that they're implementing. That's fine. Like, that's how government works. But if it's an issue of dismantling the government, that's where the difference is, I think, with Trump. And we saw this towards the end of his first administration, in that, like, the people who were working in the federal agencies, the political appointees, they were people who were not experienced. They were people who, it was not even like the A or B team. Like, it was just like the C, D, E, F team. You know, like, it was bad. Like, it was bad. And I'll give you an example. I won't name the person, but there was a person who worked at USCIS as a supervisor. He supervised 8 people. He eventually took like one of the top jobs in the State Department and oversaw, you know, things worldwide. Like, you went from supervising 8 people to like running like this worldwide operation. And that's just because like the pool was really shallow. Like, it was really, really shallow. And that damages our country, because, you know, the government, you can talk about bureaucracy all day and like why it's bad or whatever. But at the end of the day, like, the government provides very, very important services to the United States, like, military aside and like what they're doing to keep and preserve our freedom. But, you know, you've got, you know, the FDA making sure that the drugs that we take are safe. You've got Health and Human Services. You've got just like Transportation Administration and making sure our highways are safe and our bridges are safe. NTSB to investigate, like, why did a plane crash and how can we make sure it doesn't happen again? All of those things are really, really important to Americans, and we don't fully appreciate it day to day because we don't see, you know, we can drink our water that comes out of the faucet because we have a federal agency that makes sure that it's safe for us to drink. You know, like, all of those things are things that the government does. And if those are dismantled, the way of life of Americans is going to change drastically and not for the better.
And you would hold the president responsible for those things based on the people that he brings in?
Some of that, but also if you look at, you know, Project 2025 and some of the things he wants to do with Schedule F, in particular, and essentially eliminating the civil service and replacing them with political appointees. Political appointees are loyal to the president and are there. And, you know, we have political appointees now, but the political appointees are there to ensure that the president's policies are prioritized in whatever federal agency that they're in. But to have just like regular rank and file employees, like for me, I went through, I think it was 5 administrations in my time in the government. And, you know, I worked just as hard under Trump as I did under Obama. And that's because my job was not to be political and to worry about, you know, is this like if what I was doing was legal, then I was going to do it regardless of whether or not my personal feelings supported it. That's how it is. And that's how it should be. Like, federal employees, if they're not appointees, should just be neutral and just do the job regardless of what their personal opinions are.
Can you tell us a little more about the 2025 project? Do you know a lot about it? Have you investigated it?
It's 920 pages, and they probably said what they needed to say in about 25. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of aspects to it. I have not read all 920 pages. I do have concerns in particular about the federal employees and what they're going to do with the federal employees. But I know Trump has tried to distance himself from it. But, you know, the person who helped write it was a person who has done similar things for previous presidents and has had success in implementing a good chunk of what was proposed. I think Trump distances himself because he's has seen the backlash and he wants to get elected. But at the same time, like, we know that he has expressed some of the things that are in Project 2025 are things that he has supported. And I think we would be fools to think that he wouldn't implement a lot of the things that are in that project or that proposal.
You mentioned Kellyanne Conway a little while ago, and she's the one who coined the phrase, I believe, alternative facts. Which I guess would go along with your disinformation versus misinformation theory that we talked about. To what degree do you think the idea of alternative facts is doing damage to our political system or our country or to us or to you and me?
Yeah, I think it's disinformation, whether it comes from, you know, a president themselves or foreign government influence, all of that is really, it's sowing division. And, you know, we need to have those critical thinking skills to be able to question what's being told to us. Because I do worry about, like, some of the things that I see online, and particularly on social media, like, it's just blatantly untrue. And people are like, oh yeah, and like, wait, like, why, like, this is not true, how do you not know this isn't true? And so I think that's where, I think for me, that's what the most dangerous part is that you have people believing things that, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, people would laugh at because it's just so crazy. Like, go back to Trump's discussion about Kamala Harris turning black. Like, what does that even mean? Like, poof, one day she was black. Like, what does that even mean? And for people to be supportive of that and to believe that and to perpetuate that narrative, it's just craziness. Like, it's just craziness. Like, I think, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, people would be like, well, I saw pictures of her when she was younger and she was still black. And like, it would be dismissed. Like, it would just be completely dismissed. And now it's not. And that's just crazy.
Well, isn't he just saying she's dishonest because she portrayed herself as one thing and now she's portraying herself as another thing?
Like, I think if you're trying to put logic to it, sure. But the way he phrased it was not like that. It was one day she turned black. Okay, was she white the day before? Like,
you make it difficult for me to play devil's advocate with you, Julie Ford. Is there a danger, do you think, with Trump just being on the ballot, that is, whether he wins or loses, do you think that there is going to be another January 6th kind of problem?
I think there could be if Trump loses. I do expect that he probably will lose at this point. If you asked me that last month, I would say no, he was going to win. But I do think he probably is going to lose. So I think it does pose a danger. I think what's interesting to me and something that I worry about is Trump is going to be too old to run again. So he's not going to run in 4 years. He's going to be older than Biden was now. So he's not going to run again. But who comes in behind Trump? And is that person, does the Republican Party like self-correct and get more reasonable people, or do they go further extreme? And so what happens after Trump, post-Trump? And that I think, and what is his influence going to be even if he loses? Because if he loses, we have the immediate issue of January 6th, although I do think the Capitol Police will be more prepared this time around. There's going to be a wall and things like that around the Capitol. But, what happened? What's Trump's influence? I mean, I would think that his influence would not be as strong because there's no hope of him becoming president again because I don't see him running again in 4 years. So what does he do? Does he just go away? We can all hope, or, but who comes in behind him?
So, do you think that the MAGA movement, like the Tea Party movement, I mean, it's just another kind of more extreme version of the Tea Party movement. Is it something that's here to stay and there'll just be another Trump after Trump?
I hope not. I hope not. I think it's going to be very telling the next year or so, because if Republicans are smart, and hopefully they are, they're going to see, okay, he's lost twice now. He has cost us down ballot races. And so he's not a winning ticket. So we need to pivot if we want to continue to win. Like that would be this politically strategic way of handling it, whether or not they do that. I don't know. That's yet to be seen.
Well, you published your book this year. Was it published in 2024 or 23? Published in 23.
24. Yeah.
Domestic Darkness, and it's been out there for a while. Have you gotten a lot of good feedback or some bad feedback? What kind of feedback have you received?
Yeah, mostly it's been good, which is exciting. You're always like, you're holding your breath when it comes out. I'm like, I hope people like it. So yeah, it has been positive, and that's a relief for me. Yeah, and I'm glad I wrote the book. It's been an experience. It's been just like a wild ride, just like the whole past, since 2020. It's been pretty crazy. But yeah, the book was well received. I really appreciate everyone going out and buying it, reading it. And it's been a fun ride, and I've met some really interesting people, and the book has opened doors and given me different opportunities that I wouldn't necessarily have had otherwise.
Well, it's a great book. I recommend it to everybody, and it's very well written and laid out so well, and you're very articulate in your telling of your story. And now you've been writing some op-eds. I've seen them. Is that something you're going to pursue, or do you have another book in you?
Actually, my publicist is like, you need to write a book about running for office. And she's like, and it's a better book if you lost. I was like, okay. So I'm thinking about that, for sure. I'm thinking about that. I've been doing a lot of ghostwriting as well, for political related ghostwriting. And so I will probably pursue that for the next 90 days or so until the election comes. That will keep me busy. But I do think I would like to write another book, probably political in nature, because politics is exciting and frustrating, and it gives me hope. It makes me worry, all of that.
Well, it is my hope that you're going to run for office again.
Well, thank you. I don't know if I will, but thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate your honesty and your facility with factual material.
Oh,
Facts.
thank
That's what makes you a bad politician, is you're so factual all the time.
Yeah, well, my partner, he likes his cigars, and he goes most afternoons to the cigar shop near here, and there's a lot of like well-connected political people. There's a very well-connected person to a very high-ranking Republican congressman. And he's like, listen, she just needs to say what she needs to say to get those votes. Don't worry. And then once she gets elected, she can do whatever she wants. But she just needs to. And I was like, no, that's like not my approach.
That's how it works, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly how it works, right? You say what you need to say to get elected, and then, right? And then you do it.
But I would feel so like dirty doing that. Like I just felt so awful, like asking people for money, like, and it's just fundraising. It's just all of it is just ugh. Yeah.
And you were running for a seat on the Arlington, what was it? The
county board.
County board. You weren't running for governor or mayor or any of those things.
No, although local politics is even harder than that, but
you could aim higher.
Well, it's, I mean, we have,
State.
But even at the congressional federal level, like you have the same pool of voters, or at least around here. You know, Don Beyer represents Arlington, in a small section of the next city over, but you know, it's the same pool of voters here. So there's truth to like all politics are local. People want to know, like, what are you going to do for you, whether it's at the county level. And Arlington's the smallest self-governing county in the United States. And so Arlington is a county, but it's a city, and there's no other city in Arlington County. And so, yeah, I mean, it's the same people who are voting. And whether you're at the county level, the state level, or the federal level, it's the same pool of voters.
Well, your Julie for Arlington website went away, but do you have a website where people can find you and read your op-eds and things like that?
I don't, but I am on Twitter, or X now. It's Julie Farnham is my username, and I usually do post those there.
Okay, good. And I think maybe you need a website. There should be a central place where people can read all your stuff.
I could do that, yes.
All right. You can credit me. You can thank me later.
I will.
your book, and it's a great book, is called Domestic Darkness, An Insider's Account of the January 6th Insurrection and the Future of Right-Wing Extremism, which is not easy to say, by the way, right-wing extremism. Julie Farnham, thank you so much for spending some time with us again on From the Book Show.
Thank you so much.
Joining me now is From the Bookshelf book contributor, Lissa Warren. She's the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. And she's a professor at Emerson College in Boston. And she joins us often here on From the Bookshelf. Lissa Warren, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Gary. Good to be with you.
What have you been reading lately?
I've been reading a wonderful book called I Hate It Here, Please Vote for Me. And the subtitle is Essays on Rural Political Decay. It's by a guy named Matthew Ferrance. He is a creative writing professor at Allegheny College in Pennsylvania. He starts the book by saying politics is at heart a literary problem because politics relies, like so much else, on a shared belief in stories. And of course, loving literature as I do, he had me on that phrase. He goes on to document a political campaign that he waged quite unsuccessfully, like remarkably unsuccessfully, actually, for the Pennsylvania House of Representatives years ago. And he was running as a very liberal, progressive person in a deeply conservative rural district. And he was running against a longtime incumbent. It's no surprise that he lost, but the story of how Matt Ferrance got shellacked, and even more importantly, how American political narratives refuse to recognize the existence and the value of non-conservative rural Americans, offers a lot of insight into the political state of our nation. So it could not be more relevant in this day and age. He has a handlebar mustache. He doesn't look like your typical politician. You know, it's kind of no surprise that he ran, but I think that he lost. But I think the big surprise is that he ran. And he states one of the reasons that he ran is the fact that his opponent felt very strongly that literature and the English degree in general were just a giant waste of time. And he feels that those things are key to understanding each other and key to making a difference in the world. His opponent used the phrase, people who study poetry or other pre-Walmart majors. So he really thought, you have no future if you major in poetry. Gary, I majored in poetry. I mean, it's what I got my master's degree in. I know you can go on to contribute heartily to the world.
Well, you have
I admire the fact that he threw his hat into the ring on this.
And, you could open a little poetry store down the street.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I love the fact that this guy who, you know, doesn't look the part of a, quote, rural American, still just wanted to make a difference and got up off his couch and, you know, left his very cushy jade job as a professor in order to focus his time on running for office. Have you ever thought of running for office?
Not me, no. But I was just talking with Julie Farnham, author of Domestic Darkness, a book that you turned me on to, and she just had an unsuccessful run for office. And it's kind of the opposite of your tell me the name of your author again.
Matthew Ferentz.
It's the opposite of Matthew Ferentz's situation because she was running in a liberal district and they considered her to be too conservative, even though she is pretty liberal.
She is, absolutely. Very liberal. Yeah. Yeah. I'm surprised that they didn't. I don't know. I think they probably saw or heard what they wanted to see and hear rather than who she actually is and what she actually represents.
And people we were talking about all the terrible things that people said about her online. I was saying, you know, one reason I couldn't run for office is I'm way too thin skinned. But what about you? Do you take criticism well when people?
I do. I just assume everyone who's criticizing me is stupid. That's not a very nice way to go through life, I guess. Kind of. But yeah, that's what I think when I hear somebody who takes issue with me. I think either they don't know me or they just don't get me, or that it's them, not me. I guess that's how I look at it.
So does he write about what it's like to be in the public eye and have people saying things true or untrue about him?
He does talk about that, but he has a very thick skin, admirably thick skin. And what he just really seemed to enjoy was getting out there and meeting people and, you know, meeting them where they're at. Like if that meant that he needed to go and show a goat at a county fair to seem of the people and to get to know people, then that's what he would do. If he needed to plant native grasses on his front lawn because there were people who were, you know, ecologically and environmentally minded who would see that as a positive thing, and because he wanted to sort of, you know, demonstrate some of the paths that need to be taken to solve the climate crisis, you know, rather than just talk about them, like show that he believes in it enough to actually do it, then that's what he would do. I mean, he was willing to do whatever it takes, and he was willing to shoulder whatever criticism he got for it. And he did get some, but he accepted that as just part of the deal. I mean, he was bummed that he lost just like anybody else, and he doesn't think he's going to run again. But I still give him credit for the try, because like even just the amount of paperwork that you have to fill out, my gosh, in order to run, it would just stop a lot of people in their tracks, and the money involved too.
Yeah, the money,
of course.
Yeah. And when I was just talking with Julie Farnham, and she also doesn't plan to run again. And that's discouraging, because I think good people should run. We were talking about the difference between running for office and actually governing.
Mm. Very different skill set required, I think, in a lot of cases.
Yeah, I think so, too, because I think she would probably be great at doing the job that she was running for, but maybe not as great as at running.
Yeah, she could absolutely do the job. And I think, you know, certain people would recognize while she's campaigning how incredible she is. But I think you have to really talk with her in depth about her ideas to see what she brings to the table. And I'm not sure everyone wants to make that investment in time and effort to really get to know a candidate.
I guess
they want a slogan and a sign. That's it.
I guess you could say the same thing about President Biden. That is, right now, he's not very good at running for office, but Obviously, he's very good at being president since he's actually doing it.
I would say that's absolutely true. And I give him credit for stepping out of the way when he realized that in this political climate, he just wasn't going to be able to be the kind of candidate that we needed, not president that we needed, but candidate that we needed.
So tell us again the name of the book.
I Hate It Here, Please Vote For Me, Essays on Rural Political Decay. And it's published by West Virginia University Press. And it is just out August 1st. It hit bookstores. So it's brand spanking new.
And the author's name?
Matthew Ferentz.
I'm going to remember it now.
Three's a charm. You yeah. might.
Lisa Warren, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf. I always appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.